The quantization of the space base T star SU2. The cotangent bundle of SU2. And that did correspond to the quantization of our observable algebra of one edge. And so we can actually proceed to consider the quantum geometry associated to this one edge. There's not so much you can do about one edge. Well, the tech has actually something which you know as the length. And so now one can actually define the length operator. And so it's not surprisingly, it involves the fluxes. And remember how we defined everything versus, I think, in this direction. Dual edge and gamma, gamma star. And the integrated flux was defined by taking here the frame of the triad and projecting it to gamma star dot, to the tangent vector of gamma star. And if you remember that the little, so these were basically the co-triads, which we put. So one considered something like this expression. And as you hopefully remember, the co-triad had something to do with the metric. So in fact, we introduced them actually in the three-dimensional, in the covariant picture, in the space-time picture. So here we would have a spatial picture, a spatial matrix, QAB. And to measure the length of a curve, I would have to determine, in fact, the length of these matrix. So there was a contraction. Of this tangent vector to this curve. So that would be really the metric length of this curve. So what we expect if the flux was something involving this expression, that the length will involve something like the square or the sum of the square of the little fluxes. And so in fact, that's why we will consider the sum of the fluxes. So I define an operator, which I call L squared for some reason. And so it's the length of the dual curve. And let's check how it acts. I mean, here it's how I define it. It'll be the square and then the sum over the components of my flux operator. So this is associated to E. Okay, and then it acts on the spin network. So this is the definition of L squared, and I figure out at once how it acts on the spin network. And actually this we had Friday. Friday Friday, we considered how the left action, the left translations and the right translations act on the spin network basis. And we figured out that depending on what was left and what was right, we were basically leaving the J index invariant. And one of them was just changing this index, and the other was just changing by this index. And this changing happened via multiplication with a representation matrix G. So the fluxes are now defined, if you remember, actually, I think we used, I would say, the multiplication from the right, so the right translations. I'm correct. I hope I am, but otherwise I have to correct it. These fluxes were basically defined to be the action, the infinitesimal action of this of these right translations. And so if this acts by multiplying with a representation matrix of exponential Tj, so this is Tj, and you take the derivative, you get just the representation matrix Tj. And so this is what we get. I think they didn't. So let's write that somehow bigger. Actually, it used to be the multiplication from the left. Yeah, no, actually, I was right. Okay, so from what we had yesterday, we defined the flux as a left invariant derivative. We just defined to be the infinitesimal action of translations from the right. Acting on this basis. And so this we figured out yesterday how it acts on this basis. Saying that the right entry actually is a representation space for the representation J with respect to this right translations. And so we just multiply all these vectors P with this group element. Exponential t, tk. And so basically this you could define as a representation matrix associated to the Lie algebra element tk. So you can define it in this way, and it turns out to be actually exactly the J representation of the Lie algebra. And so we get this formula, the square of these things. And now I hope there will be things happening, which I hope you have seen at some point in your life, because it's basically just arguments from the quantum mechanics of angular momentum. Okay, so we basically have that L squared acts as this matrix multiplication index in this index, and this happens via the sum over the generators of this Lie algebra, and then we evaluated this J. So let's define basically this operator. This is just the sum of these Lie algebra elements in the representation J. And we multiply these two representation matrices. And so it turns out this is a matrix. You can now just consider its action on representation space on VJ. And so you can consider the commutator of the CJ with any other Lie algebra element acting in this representation. And this will be zero. And so what you use is just the commutation relations for these Lie algebra TKs. So I claimed these DJs are representation. So these representation matrices will give you back exactly the commutation relations. So there are two here. And you see what will happen is that you get an epsilon, one epsilon. Plus another epsilon there, and I hope you get them in the anti-symmetric commutation, which means that they give together zero. So this turns out to be actually zero. And what you get is actually that this operator commutes with all representation matrices of this Lie algebra elements. So it commutes with all with the Lie algebra basis. And this is called a Casimir operator. Okay, and basically these Casimir operators, as you might know, is basically make your life very simple in quantum mechanics. You might have known it in a different context. Always, if you want to diagonalize a given operator and you find operators which commute with these operators, you know that you only need to go to basically the subspaces left invariant by this operator. So that's what charges are good for. And in fact, so we know that this operator is a Casimir operator, and if a form of this kind of general knowledge and group theory is called, I mean, general knowledge. This was there before in group theory, before quantum mechanics, I guess. So there's Schur's lemma, also I'm not sure, we should check. Schur's lemma basically says that if you have an operator which commutes, or which kind of, it's called intertwines with the action of a group or Lie algebra element, and you know that this operator acts on an irreducible representation. So we have an operator C. So I basically write you the small version of the thing, because it's, you can of course generalize everything here. Action of all. So now we deal with a Lie group, a Lie algebra. It generalizes to groups. So if you know two things, that the operator C commutes with an action of all Tj and it acts on an irreducible representation, then this operator is necessarily equal to the identity or proportional to the identity with some eigenvector lambda. And so we basically figured out also on Friday that these states GMN, so they this basically GM fixed and N was running in whatever J allows, so this is minus J until plus J in steps of plus one. That this is in fact gives you the representation Vj, and we see that Cj leaves this space invariant. So we know that Cj, we don't even need to diagonize it, it is already supposed to be diagonal, and in fact it just corresponds to the standard Casimir operator of SU2. Modulo constants. And so the only thing, so C is the standard, I mean, it's actually the one and only one. The only non-trivial one, I should say. Which is quadratic in the entries. And so as such C da in fact acts as unit operator on these representation spaces, and lambda can be determined to be J times J plus one for the representation J. And this again, you can derive as an argument. I've never seen that. So you can derive that with arguments which are similar to the angular momentum operator, and it's in the script how to do that. Alternatively, you really figure out what the square is, because you need it only to figure that out on one given state, and you have to go through the R to find the simplest state. So taking all constants together, which is especially some minus signs there, and the h bar and so on. So we see that L squared E star, first of all, we know it really, I mean, it leaves these indices invariant, and on this index, it actually acts on as an identity. So L squared leaves spin networks, or the spin at these basis elements invariant completely. And on these spin networks, it has a spectrum which only depends on J. So each eigenvalue comes how often? Yeah, you have to count these number of elements n, and then m also runs from minus j to plus j. Okay. It's d j squared. And here you have the spectrum h squared j, j plus 1, where j runs in the half integers. And so we have this key result of loop quantum gravity that at least this geometric operator has discrete spectrum, and more importantly, it has a discrete spectrum. I mean, zero is in the spectrum because J can be zero, and has discrete spectrum away from zero. So the next smallest spectrum is zero. or is if you put here 1/2. And so now you would like, of course, to know how big is this? And for this, you would have to put back units. And at some point, we put kappa equal to zero, where kappa was maybe 1/8 pg or something. But it was a g of 3D gravity, which brings us into the little problem that we don't know what g of the 3D gravity is. So we can only say this is h kappa 3d, j, j plus 1. And in fact, the units of this kappa are different in different dimensions. and so in fact, the Planck length in 3D is h bar times is kappa 3d. and here you get consistency, of course, that this is the length squared. And so to get the length, we would have to take the square root. And by functional analysis, to get to know what the function of an operator is, we have to diagonalize this operator and then basically take the function of the spectrum. So in this case, the spectrum of L is indeed given by the square root of these values. So and unfortunately in 3D, we don't really know what kappa 3D is. I mean, that would be one of these things which you would have to determine by an experiment. So you have to find something which models 3D gravity, which you actually could nowadays, apparently, depending on, in for instance, graphene. Okay. So actually, what I have to convince you is that this is really the length operator. So this was basically the argument that, in fact, This should be somehow related to the length up operator. So a more formal argument, you see that there's some approximation going on, is as follows. You basically consider the length of a curve. Which is just the standard formula of this. And as I told you previously, QAB is just replaced by the code riots. And now there's this stuff, now there comes the stuff which is not very well defined. This is always L squared. All of these mistakes. No, this is actually L because we have taken the square root here. So one approximates this integral by Riemann sum. So that's the integral, that's the Riemann sum. It's still sum over k. And basically we take these little things. As our flux operators, associated to small curves, En. So basically, remind you that we are looking at the curve of the dual of gamma. So what we need to do is to subdivide the dual curve, which here is just called gamma star. and here we have lots of these actually edges, E1, E2, and the En, which go through this curve. And each of these lengths, each of these spin network, so basically these would be spin network edges, give an amount add to the length of this curve by one of these spectral values. So basically, if you want to know the curve of a bigger curve, of a like big, where big is not well defined, for big curve, you would have to chop it up in little pieces and apply this operator. And basically apply this formula where you have should restore actually units, which is done here. so let me just comment some on these expressions, big and small. So big and small, you don't know what it is because there's no metric a priori. So actually, the thing you have is a state-dependent notion of size, and it's actually also not so much size. Actually, I would rather like it to call something like of complexity of your state. And so So how much you have to subdivide this curve to measure the length depends on your state. And I haven't really defined you what the state is. I mean, I mentioned that it's graphs. So imagine that you actually have a state which lives on a graph, which has just this one edge in this region. And in fact, you want to measure the length of this one curve. So I should maybe, we should basically differentiate. So this is a length operator kind of curve. And you apply it to a state where only this one curve goes through this one, to this length operator pink curve. So in this case, you can indeed apply this formula and subdivide that in many small pieces. And you will find, because basically that's what I didn't explain, if you don't have a curve, I mean, if you don't have a spin network here, you don't have a spin network edge, this state is actually equivalent to having no dependence on the group. It's actually equivalent to having something in the basis state, which is j equal to 0. Or if you basically put it into the holonomy representation, they have a constant function here. So in this case, that's what I haven't been explained a lot in these lectures, because we do 3D, and in 3D it's fine to just deal with a kind of discretization. And in these cases, if you really deal with a discretization, you would actually never think what happens if you apply an operator somewhere where nothing is happening. But actually in LQG, depending on the representation, you basically have to specify what happens in regions where a priori there is no state. And in standard LQG, it's basically specified that a region with no edges is equivalent, if you draw an edge, that you put basically j equal to 0 on this edge. And if j equal to 0, the magnetic indices have also to be 0. And this is a trivial representation, which is equivalent to having the constant function here. So what kind of lengths do you get from the state? You take the derivative of a constant function and square this derivative. You get zero lengths. So the point is that you can subdivide it a lot, but the only non-vanishing contribution you get from this edge, if it actually is j not equal to 0. And so in this case, you can actually easily take the limit of arbitrary refined subdivision here. And you know, at some point, as soon as there is basically only one spin network edge per interval, you will basically get always a constant result, and you will basically have trivial convergence of this limit. And so that's actually always how it works in this context, that the limit, in a sense, or this notion of convergence, in a sense, it depends on the state you apply it to. So basically, if you have more edges here, you can have infinitely many more edges. You have to go a bit further with refining this pink edge. But then, you know, in case you have finitely many edges, which is kind of the general assumption, you will always find some subdivision after which it basically gives you a constant result applying this operator, and so you find constant. I mean, so you find basically the expression for this operator. So that's actually the reason Why also we so far have always talked in general discretization terms. However, everything can be done in a context where you deal with a continuum theory. And the main point which we have to do in dealing with a continuum theory is that we indeed, so far we had these single edges for the states. So basically, the main point is that one has to clarify always what happens if someone comes and draws you an additional edge. What is the state on this edge? And for this Ashtika-Lewandowski, it's a very simple Ashtika-Lewandowski would be basically the construction we are now doing. Lewandowski representation. It would be this description to put J equal to zero on the state, which also means that you have zero length for any curve. I mean, not for any curve, but this spinner curve gives you zero length. So I can draw you a very complicated graph. If I put always J equal to zero there, it is basically the simplest state. You can imagine it's a constant function on all group elements. So obviously, kind of the notion of kind of length in, on your piece of paper where you draw your states and the actual volume, or in this case, length operators or area operators might not be connected at all. And the kind of disadvantage of this representation is that, in fact, if you want to give a reasonable geometry to such a state, you need to have a very fine graph, very dense graph. Because always, if you have kind of a priori in this interpretation, this region would always have, in a sense, no geometry. Or it has a geometry, but this geometry tells you that like this curve has zero length. And then it depends on whether you think it's such states are useful or not. Okay. And actually, recently, we've defined another representation which behaves quite differently, where and it's a bit more complicated, so that's why we are not yet going through it. Where in fact you kind of, I mean, everything is dual in this representation, so it's a bit hard to motivate it from this point of view. But in fact, it says you can add instead in 2D, instead of edges, you basically can add vertices in a triangulation. And what I have to tell you is what happens with the state, which basically describes this added vertex. And the description is that the state has to have is peaked on having flat connection around any loop around this vertex, any loop which only surrounds this vertex. So it actually is peaked, the vacuum in this case is peaked on flat connection, whereas you cannot say anything about the flux. So the fluxes are basically infinitely spread, or as much spread as possible in this vacuum at least. And in fact, the zero connection or zero curvature, it's a constraint of 3D gravity. So basically, in a sense, this other representation would be rather suited for 3D gravity. It's technically a bit more complicated because addition, the refinement operation. So here I was just adding edges and I was just writing J equal to zero. So in the other case, you have to add slightly, we can only add slightly more complicated things. And depending on your viewpoint, adding something like a delta function in the connection or in the holonomy, you can see that as more complicated or as less complicated. Okay. So, but this tells you, so these things can be actually made sense of in a continuum theory. And so the spectrum is discrete really as a result of the continuum theory. The one thing one can complain about is that this operator is not a Dirac observable yet, with respect to diffeomorphisms and Hamiltonian operators. And a priori, it's hard to say something about the spectrum of Dirac observables based on what you know about the spectrum of kinematical observables. However, in 3D, again, the situation is much nicer. So in principle, one actually knows what the Dirac observables are. And I've mentioned it in the very first lecture. There's these curves which you cannot contract to zero. So basically, these would be non-trivial curves in the first fundamental curve, in the first fundamental group. In a torus, they would go around the donut thing. And so like the length of these curves is at least diffeomorphism invariant in with respect to the spatial diffeomorphisms. And then in principle, using this the things of spatial and partial and complete observables, you can define Dirac observables and you can consider the length of these curves, which has been done, but in a different quantization. And the results are there actually a bit different. Okay. So we have discussed one edge, and I mentioned spin networks. And so this one edge is also something in a completely kinematical Hilbert space. So far, we haven't discussed the Gauss constraints, and we have not discussed also the flatness constraints. So the Gauss constraints are much simpler than the flatness constraints. And David asked me, so the Gauss constraints are stuff which also appears in lattice gauge theory. So actually, what I told you now, if you really in lattice gauge theory, one really takes the discretization seriously. And all the variables which we have discussed now are the same as in lattice gauge theory for Young Mills, for SU2 Young Mills, obviously. If you do SU3 Young Mills, it would be basically exactly the same, minus something which comes now, and that's basically the recoupling theory, which in SU3 is a tiny bit more complicated than in SU2. Okay, so we now go back to our Dirac quantization program, which tells us, okay, we basically have our kinematical Hilbert space. And a priori, as I told you, we could basically take any contribution, any edges. And basically, these edges would basically do two things. Firstly, we said that we can apply multiplication operators to these edges, or basically these things come from applying multiplication operators to these edges. And so they would carry the excitations from this funny vacuum, which is phi g equal to 0 for every edge, to the constant edge, to the constant function for every edge. And also, at least for the length operators, they allow us to probe the states. So they have this dual interpretation of things where I can probe states and of telling me where the excitations are. And so this will be my kinematical Hilbert space, where basically you do what you always do if you consider the Hilbert space put together from many subsystems. So far, we just have kind of lots of subsystems. This will be basically the tensor product of all these Hilbert spaces associated to these edges. And so this would be the tensor product of square integrable functions over G. And This I can you can identify at least if you are mathematically sufficiently ignorant, which we are, with the L2 product on n copies of the group, with the L2 space of n copies on the group, where n is, maybe I write E, the number of edges you have. And this would be the completely kinematical Hilbert space. And so we would have to take this Hilbert space and impose the Gauss constraints. And if you remember how the Gauss constraints looked like, they were certainly kindly messy because there was a kind of derivative of E of these fluxes. So we would have to think, what does the derivative of E? Okay, and then there was some epsilon and then connection and then E. And then we are immediately in trouble because we don't know, we actually can't quantize the connection in itself. And there's this derivative of E. And so we wouldn't know how to quantize this Gauss constraint. So this is quite complicated. But actually, we discussed the action of the Gauss constraint. In some of these lengthy lectures, and this was comparatively simple. I mean, it was not really simple because the formulas looked not simple, but what we figured out is that the Gauss constraints generate gauge transformations, and we know basically we now have here functions on the holonomies. And we know how gauge transformations act on the holonomies, except that, yeah, doesn't. And this was that if you have an edge E, H E G minus 1. Okay, I don't know whether I'm consistent in having always the same notation and source vertex and target vertex. So this is the final vertex and this is the source vertex VB. Basically, if I deal with functions, with functions as the holonomies, I know how these holonomies transform under gauge transformations, which also tells me how the functions transforms. And moreover, we can now express kind of this kind of translate, this time this kind of action, because we discussed left and right translations. And these things are just left and right translations. So basically, I can write this action of a gauge transformation as applying left and right translation operators to my state. And so there's only this annoying g minus 1 you have to do, depending on what, I mean, you can actually also define it the other way around. It depends on where you want to have a group action. And left and right translation, if you remember, one of them, the left one was defined to act with a minus 1. And so this gives you the different distribution of minus 1 and plus 1 here. Oh, okay. So if you want to have something which is invariant under the Gauss constraint, we need, under the action of the Gauss constraint, we need something which would be invariant under left and right translations. And these left and right translations are not even the same state, not even with respect to the same group elements, but you can have different group elements here, which are associated to the source vertex and the target vertex of this edge. So formally, we can write a projector. So that would be a projector on the Gauss constraint. You can formally, it's very formally, write this as a delta function of this Gauss constraint. And this would be the Gauss constraint on these two vertices. And actually, that's what I have never explained. But if you want to have something invariant under some group action, what can you do? You want to have a function which is invariant under translations in R. You can always average with respect to the group action. And this averaging will only work if you actually have a measure which is invariant under the group action. And luckily, we have this measure because we take this R measure. And this is invariant under left and right translation. And so you will get something which is invariant. If you have never seen that, take for instance this right translation, apply to a function fh, define this to be kind of the average function h integrated over dg. So these are right. Now you can basically check that this function is really invariant under multiplication from the right. Because this would be, by definition, equal to this expression where you first multiplied h from the left, actually, other way around, h, but then you applied the right translation to the argument, and this is this one. So you get this. And then you do a variable transformation and call this g prime. And g prime is gh. However, dg prime is dj if you apply really the invariant measure, which is a Haar measure. And so you, in fact, find if you average over the group action, then this thing and the right translated function are the same. So if you have an invariant measure, it's always quite simple to find. Simple, I mean, you need to. It's always possible to at least abstractly define invariant functions by averaging. And the first problem is that usually it's hard to find this measure. And so, kind of finding this measure is actually also associated to having an anomaly free representation of this group action and so on. And of course, the other one is that in this case, it's quite simple to do this averaging. In other cases, averaging means in the case of time translation that you need to solve the time evolution. And this in itself can be quite complicated. Okay, let me finish by saying if you just have this one edge, and you average, of course, what you will find is not much interesting because you even average a priori with different group elements. So actually, you can even absorb this group element into the here. And find a G1 prime. And so that means that what you get is independent of H. And so you just get some funny constant. And so applying the Gauss constraint to one edge Hilbert spaces just gives you the Hilbert space called C, the one dimensional Hilbert space, which is not very interesting. However, as I mean, this action, what you can do is that this action is defined to be one group element, a specific group element per vertex. So what you can do is actually to consider two edges, which are exactly glued at this vertex. And then you would know that at least, you know, the group averaging with respect to this vertex would act here, and it would act here. However, you would have to, with respect to this vertex, at least you would have to do just one group averaging, and you have at least two group elements here. So it's a two-dimensional function. Okay, and that will turn out to be medium interesting because what you get is that after group averaging, the function's invariant under this thing. And it's not too surprising because in one direction you act with h minus 1 and in the other you act with h. And so what you get is that this functions which are invariant are of this type where they just depend on the product of these arguments. So this can be also, so this will be invariant if you put h minus 1 there. So basically, we get that an edge subdivided once gives you back an edge if you impose gauge invariance. So what we have to consider is edges with at least three edges. things with at least vertices with at least three edges, and we will do that tomorrow. Okay, thank you.